We're talking about junk science on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Chris Fabricant is an expert on the use of subjective speculation in the courtroom, posed as science, and how it leads to wrongful convictions. Nearly half of all wrongful convictions overturned by DNA evidence involve the misuse of forensic sciences. That's one stat in Chris's new book, shedding light on this problem, which really upends what we've watched on CSI, right? And other crime scene investigation shows. Join in on forensic evidence, 800-642-1234. Chris Fabricant, Director of Strategic Litigation for the New York-based Innocence Project. His new book is called Junk Science and the American Criminal Justice System. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could just start by ticking off all the questionable forensic techniques that are under the umbrella of what you call junk science so we can see the breadth of this. Just do a bit of a brain dump.
Sure. We'd have to have a long list that would include blood spatter evidence, bite mark evidence, shoe print analysis, handheld tool mark evidence, cadaver dogs, comparative bullet lead analysis, hair microscopy, shaken baby syndrome diagnoses, gunshot residue. The list is extensive.
Arson was on that list too, and I did
arson,
a double
certainly.
Take. Wow. You know, I mean, because it seems like arson investigations, once they're done, it's like, you know, there it is, that this is what happened.
Yeah, what many folks don't realize is how much subjectivity there are in so many forensic techniques, and arson interpretation of fires, you know, is high amongst them. And they've gotten somewhat better over the years, and I track that progress in the book, you know, like beginning with what I argue and that many have acknowledged at last is a wrongful execution of Cameron Todd Willingham in Texas that was based on junk science and folklore that was passed down from generation to generation of fire investigators that thought that when they were viewing certain patterns on floors and certain other what they considered telltale signs of a deliberately set fire were in fact the natural occurrence as what was known as, you know, full room involvement of a fire that created these marks that fire investigators for generations had interpreted as deliberately set fires. So that's just, you know, one of many examples.
Yeah, and we'll get into all so many of these examples, but what struck me is they had to recreate the fire next door in an abandoned property to really understand that, you know, how you said it, the fire lied.
Yeah, well, you know, it was incredible. It was really that was the first scientific experiment that had really been conducted in arson investigation. You know, you would think that the scientific method, you know, where you develop a hypothesis and test it, would be done outside of the adversarial system, outside of the criminal justice system. So we would have a real understanding of the so-called science that we're using to, you know, incarcerate and send to death row, you know, American citizens. But that really wasn't the case until, you know, this first experiment that I wrote about in my book, which was, you know, right after there had been an indictment for capital murder of Gerald Lewis in Florida. And there was ample evidence to suggest that he had deliberately set this fire, just in terms of circumstantial evidence. But there was also a lot of circumstantial evidence that pointed away from innocence, or from guilt, I should say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happened, which, you know, was virtually unheard of in our justice system, was that the prosecution in that case decided to test the defendant's theory of innocence, saying that could you observe what fire investigators observed in the aftermath of a terrible a burning down of a house that killed four little kids and two women, was could you make the same observations in a accidentally set fire as they were claiming to have seen and what they were arguing was a deliberately set fire? So they recreated exact structure that had been next door to the house that had burned down was an identical structure built by the same company. They recreated all of the same conditions and they set that house on fire. And what they observed for the first time, again in a generation, was that all of these, you know, so-called arson indicators were wrong. And the capital indictment against Mr. Lewis was dismissed. and narrowly headed off what certainly would have been a wrongful conviction and a wrongful execution. And, you know, that folklore, nonetheless, some of it survives to this day.
Talking about forensic techniques that qualify as junk science with Chris Fabricant, Director of Strategic Litigation with the Innocent Project and author of the new book, Junk Science in the American Criminal Justice System. You can join in 800-642-1234. Chris, you say bite marks are the poorest of poor people's science. Can you explain that term and how it correlates with what you call junk science?
Yeah, you know, when I was researching the book, I was interested in how courts had addressed the use of what I'm calling junk science in both criminal litigation and in civil litigation. Because I became aware that there was a book in the 90s called Galileo's Revenge that was written by a person from a right-wing think tank known as the Manhattan Institute that used to be a law clerk for Sandra Day O'Connor. And what that book argued was effectively, and it popularized for the first time, the term junk science came out of this book, Galileo's Revenge. And its complaint was really about the explosion of mass tort litigation and personal injury litigation in throughout the 70s, 80s. And during that era, a lot of plaintiff's attorneys were using expert witnesses that were peddling junk science in against corporate defendants. You know, some of that litigation was righteous. You know, Ford Pintos are no longer with us, thankfully, as a result of plaintiff's attorneys using, you know, real science to demonstrate how dangerous that was. But there was a lot of junk science that was also being used. And so corporate America had gotten very tired of it, and they wanted courts to do a better job of policing the so-called scientific evidence that was being used to sue them. And so they teed up a case called Daubert. If you read it, it looks as though it should be pronounced Daubert, but I'm told that the Dauberts, that's how they pronounce their name. So this was a personal injury litigation that got to the Supreme Court, and the corporate defense bar had argued to that court that they needed to do a better job policing so-called scientific evidence and no longer defer to the scientists themselves, but would have to apply basic scientific principles to a proffer of evidence. And they won. The Supreme Court announced a new standard for the introduction of scientific evidence, and courts began excluding subjective speculation in ways that they had never done before and in percentages that had never been seen before. And, you know, much more scientific integrity was brought to the legal system. But what happened is, you know, of course, science is science, right? So it should apply in the civil side as well as the criminal side as to however we're going to evaluate science. There shouldn't be any distinction between what's used in civil and criminal law. But what 10 years after this decision was announced, Peter Neufeld, co-founder of the Innocence Project, conducted a study that demonstrated empirically that nothing had changed on the criminal side. And the scientific evidence that was being used to send people to prison and death row was still being introduced without pause, despite this new rigorous standard. And then I did a study in 2018, a follow-up study with Professor Brandon Garrett from Duke Law School, that showed even after the stat that you mentioned earlier, with 50%, nearly 50% of all wrongful convictions attributable at least in part to the use of forensic techniques that we know are unreliable, that nothing had changed, zero, and that prosecutors were able to introduce whatever they proffered despite mainstream scientific community knowing and understanding and reporting that these techniques were no longer reliable. And so I labeled the science that we're using in our criminal justice system as poor people science, because it's very clear that we don't care about the science that we use to incarcerate poor people, and largely poor people of color in this country. And so I've called it in my book, Poor People Science.
Let's pause here. Innocence Project attorney Chris Fabricant bringing awareness to what he calls junk science, poor people science. Join in on forensics, on crime labs, what you've wondered about evidence at the science of a crime. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chris Fabricant here on the Ideas Network. Bite marks, hair microscopy, ballistics, shoe prints, tire treads, arson investigation, blood spatter. We're talking about subjective science and the umbrella term junk science here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chris Fabricant, Strategic Litigation Director at the Innocence Project, draws attention to the central question in his new book. Why has junk science been accepted by courts unanimously for the past 50 years? Join in 800-642-1234. Chris Fabricant with us for the hour. So Chris, in 1985, bite mark evidence used in Wisconsin to convict Robert Lee Stinson to life in prison, and his conviction was then overturned 23 years later. The case is still considered good law or valid. What does this case signal to you, still considered good law, mean for those accused of violent crimes here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, isn't that incredible that Robert Lee Stinson, who's a free man today after 23 years of wrongful imprisonment, due almost entirely to the use of bite mark evidence against him to wrongfully convict him of a rape and murder, no, and a rape. And the, you know, and what that case found, and this was the precedent establishing case in Wisconsin for the use of bite mark evidence. It had never been used before in the state. And the court found, when it was affirming Mr. Stinson's wrongful conviction, saying that the bite mark evidence proved to a moral certainty Mr. Stinson's guilt. And he was in fact innocent. And you could go online, you could look up this case today, and you could still cite it in a brief in a court because it hasn't been overturned, right? The reality of his wrongful conviction and the reality of it being junk science has not been overturned, and you can still cite it today. And that's true with the Gary Cipazzari case in Massachusetts. That's a precedent establishing case in Massachusetts for the use of bite mark evidence. He too was innocent. He spent over 30 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. LaVon Brooks in Mississippi, the precedent establishing case for the use of bite mark evidence in that state. He was wrongfully convicted in capital murder. You could still cite that case as good law. And in fact, it was cited in one of the backbone stories of my book, the Eddie Lee Howard wrongful death sentence that he was handed for a murder and rape of an elderly white woman, a black man in Mississippi, was the state in the Supreme Court argument that I made in that case that I write about, cited the LaVon Brooks case as precedent for the continued use of bite mark evidence in Mississippi. And they knew he was innocent. Everybody knew he was innocent and nonetheless cited that case law.
Can you just pause here and explain forensic odontology and explain the technique? Because it was hard for me to make the leap between identifying people by dental records, say at a plane crash, and matching teeth to bite marks from a crime scene on a victim's body.
Right. Well, that's because you're a critical thinker. And unlike most of the courts that had considered this evidence, and that's really the way that bite mark evidence snuck into criminal courts, is that through forensic odontology, which is just a fancy word for a dentist, a forensic dentist, but it sounds very sciencey, which is why it was adopted for use in trials. And, you know, forensic dentistry has really three sub-disciplines, if you want to call it that. One would be identifying bodies through dental records. The other is dental age estimation by kind of examining your teeth to give a rough estimate of how old a person might be. And so-called bite mark evidence. And these are really completely unrelated areas, particularly between identifying bodies and identifying bite marks, but they can be made to sound as though they are just kind of opposite sides of the same coin, which is what the dentist did in court. And so they had this legitimate area of work, which is dental identification. And what they would claim essentially was that, yes, in our field, we identify people by their teeth and we identify people by the bite marks their teeth create. So that sounds, you know, in a very kind of superficial level, legitimate, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, right. You know, somehow this proximity to teeth would make a dentist capable of identifying, you know, a bite mark and matching that to somebody's, you know, potential teeth. But the reality is, and I heard this quoted line earlier in the introduction, but it, you know, it's one from my book, and where I write that, you know, it's more similar to a geologist claiming that because she can identify a rock, a particular type of rock, that she can identify the rock that was used to bash in somebody's skull, which of course is totally, you know, an opposite. But that facile logic was used in the first cases. And, you know, I write about a case in 2012 where a forensic dentist was making that same argument with success. And as late as 2012, despite the fact by that time there had been a dozen wrongful convictions attributable to bite mark evidence. So this is, you know, the problem with kind of widespread scientific illiteracy in our country as a whole. You know, I mean, and lawyers are certainly no different and probably even more susceptible to junk science, because lawyers go to law school to avoid math and judges are lawyers, right? And so, you know, why does it keep happening? You know, why do we keep allowing bite marks and new techniques and emerging technologies to come into criminal courts?
But
in addition to not caring, it's because there isn't a lot of scientific literacy.
But why might teeth appear to match one day and then not the next? How does that unfold in the courtroom?
You know, that was, you know, when we started the strategic litigation department at the Innocence Project, and I was tasked with identifying and trying to eliminate the use of bite mark evidence and trying to identify all the people who have been victimized by this technique. And, you know, so I read countless transcripts of these dentists testifying in cases, and I never saw a cross-examination that asked the question that you just asked. And that is, you know, skin changes over time, right? And so if you're talking about, you know, in a homicide, that a dentist has not typically gone and documented this injury until, you know, days later. We have no idea what that injury looked like when it was first inflicted, how much it's changed every hour, every day, every night. And it's totally unpredictable. So you can match one hour, not match the next. And there are no measurements taken. There's no predictions that can be made. It's simply eyeballed and an interpretation made. But I never really saw that question. You know, there would always be questions about, you know, well, are teeth really unique and things like that, you know, and how can you be sure, or that you would get another dentist that would disagree with the prosecution's dentist, you know, that happened in Robert Lee Stinson's case. And, you know, the defense experts are viewed as hired guns and the prosecution experts are viewed as, you know, scientists. And, you know, so those battle of the experts, you know, are lost by defendants when really there should be no battle at all. It shouldn't be used at all because it's junk science.
Chris Fabricant, author of the new book, Junk Science and the American Criminal Justice System. Let's bring on a caller. Trevor is joining us from Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Trevor.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. What would you like to bring up?
So I'm just wondering and hoping that this has never been used. Have you ever heard of a functional MRI, an fMRI?
Oh, sure. Yes. This is being used in capital litigation. You know, is the there's a lot of promise in reading the functions of our brain through, you know, this type of techniques. It's totally unvalidated for the using the way that's being used in criminal trials, in my view, and it's premature to admit this technology.
Exactly. I heard about a case in Italy where some scientists were tried for this volcano that went off and people died, and they tried to claim that the scientists had functional knowledge. And they had to say, like, look, guys, we can research and stuff, but, like, that's not how this works. And it just concerned me because, you know, I've seen a lot of practices that I didn't think were so great here, and I wanted some peace of mind talking to you guys. So hopefully, I mean, it's not used in America, is it?
You know, it has been tried. It is not common yet. You know, what happens with forensic techniques is that there will be a particular case where it becomes at issue and becomes important to a particular case. And then what will often happen is that one judge will let one technique in for one particular case, and you know the judgment that's being exercised there is not viewed with as a system-wide, the impact that it's going to have systemically. It's thinking about this one case. And in forensics in particular, one decision that admits a particular technique that hasn't been, you know, properly validated through the scientific research is really carte blanche for the use of that technique around the country. And even though it's not a Supreme Court case, it sets a precedent everywhere. We've seen that, and I've, you know, I write about that problem in my book.
And we need to pause right there, Chris Fabricant, exploring junk science. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Bite mark evidence is never good evidence under any circumstance. That's according to Innocence Project attorney Chris Fabricant. We're exploring his book about what he calls junk science plaguing America's justice system on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The fact is, bite marks are admissible evidence, but they were one of 13 forensic techniques critiqued in a landmark study by the National Academy of Sciences in 2009. NPR's coverage at the time included then U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions' reaction.
I don't think we should suggest that those proven scientific principles that we've been using for decades are somehow uncertain.
Join in 800-642-1234. Chris Fabricant with us for the hour. Chris, you know, you said figuratively that a bomb went off when the National Academy of Sciences published its report in 2009 that really struck at the perception of the reliability of forensic evidence. What impact did this report have?
Well, it was the first time that mainstream scientists had looked under the hood of the forensic sciences that had been used in criminal courts for a century in this country. It was, you know, these forensic techniques are largely been developed through law enforcement entities, you know, crime scene investigators, crime laboratories that are associated with law enforcement, the FBI crime lab. There was a strong incentive for touting the validity of these techniques. They were being used in for, as I said, a century in criminal convictions and in capital litigation and putting people to death. So there was always very strong incentive not to question forensics that were used in this country. There was a strong incentive not to question the progenitors of these techniques, which was largely the FBI crime lab in Quantico, Virginia, that had developed these, you know what I mean? And the reputation of, you know, the forensic pathologists of great fame, you know, that was, you know, kind of personified by the shows like Quincy during that era, and the way that the FBI crime lab was depicted in shows, you know, going back from Law and Order through, you know, today in CSI.
There's so much cachet. I mean, it's the FBI crime lab.
Right, right. And so, you know, I mean, and so in popular culture, popular imagination, and in criminal courts, forensics were believed to be infallible. And this was despite, you know, by the time the National Academy of Sciences report in 2009, it had already been clear that many of these forensic techniques were leading to wrongful convictions. But that hadn't been enough, really, to send the thunderbolt that the NAS did through this community, because you know, they were viewed as lawyers and, you know, playing, you know, spectacular, you know, catastrophes, but not really fundamental bad science. It was thought of bad apples, you know, mistakes were made, you know, those types of excuses were offered for the failures of those forensic techniques. But when the National Academy of Sciences looked at it and looked at the literature and looked at the assumptions that were being made and the conclusions that were being offered as scientific evidence in criminal trials, it was really, you know, it's fair to say, it's fair to characterize mainstream scientists' reaction as flabbergasted, is that just couldn't believe that so little actual research had been done to support these techniques. You know, so when it looked at something like bite marks, it said, wow, this is really nonsense, right? There's so many inherent problems with this technique, just beginning with the idea that you could interpret an injury of skin like this. You know, I mean, there's no evidence of that. And so, you know, what it looked at was 13 of the most commonly used forensic techniques in this country still today, and found that only DNA evidence, you know, not firearms or what's sometimes called ballistics, not fingerprints, not tire treads, not shoe prints, not any other forensic technique is capable of identifying the source of crime scene evidence, despite, you know, criminal trial or criminal courts accepting that evidence for as long as anybody can remember.
But the Deputy Attorney General at the time, Sally Yates, wanted to put the FBI forensic techniques through what she called a stress test. What impact did that have on the FBI and its forensic sciences that had been so upheld?
None.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the reality is, you know, I mean, is what you're referring to is a speech, a keynote speech that the DAG, Sally Yates, made at a meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences in the aftermath of the FBI's audit of hair comparison cases. So, you know, I write about it in my book that my first week at the Innocence Project really was the same week of the largest forensic scandal in this country's history, when the Department of Justice and the FBI came to the Innocence Project and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and finally admitted, after 70 other wrongful convictions attributable to the use of hair comparison evidence, that the technique was being misused. And that the conclusions that we've just been talking about, right, identifying the source, right, well, this hair came from that person or very likely came from that person, was bogus, and that the technique was not capable of supporting those types of claims. And it agreed to audit thousands of prior convictions to see how many other people have been wrongfully convicted on this junk science. And, you know, that was really astonishing. And that was at least as impactful as the NAS report to the forensic community, because it was the FBI itself admitting error, which is very, very uncommon. And, you know, what Sally Yates was saying was that, and in recognition of the statistical reality of all these other pattern matching techniques, including firearms analysis, that you can't make those types of claims. You can't say that bullet came from that gun to the exclusion of every other gun ever manufactured in the history of time. The science doesn't support that. And Sally Yates had made a promise, the DOJ had made a promise to correct the record and to go back and look and see whether or not what she said were these same overstatements that they'd seen in hair comparison evidence had leaked into these other techniques. And of course it had leaked in, It's the norm. It's the norm today.
Which goes to asking you, what is that legacy of the National Academy of Sciences report? Where are we at today?
Well, all of the litigation that I do at the Innocence Project and the other lawyers in my department that work on junk science cases, it's the foundation of our litigation. It's the foundation of the discussion that we have with forensic experts around the country. It has created change. It's just very, very slow. And, you know, for example, the idea that you would even need objective scientific research that was done by mainstream scientists with no stake in the continued use of this technique was even a necessary thing was really not discussed prior to the 2009 report. The idea that law enforcement should not be in control of forensic sciences, right? It should be, there should be no prosecutor science or defense science, or it should be science and it shouldn't be tied to law enforcement. That was a concept that was not discussed prior to the NAS report. The idea that expert witnesses should be shielded from biasing information, that too, never an issue before the NAS report. So all these, you know, kind of mainstream scientific concepts have been slowly introduced into forensic sciences. And so that its continued legacy is really should not be understated. My frustration is the human beings that are still being incarcerated and sent to death row on claims that the NAS has debunked as far back as 2009. And you see from that clip that you played of Jeff Sessions when he was Attorney General, when that report was released, is just how disruptive to the status quo the critique of the mainstream scientific community was of the use of forensics in this country. And that battle that Sessions kicked off in 2009 continues today.
He was a senator then in Alabama.
Oh, that's right.
No, that's okay. I'm just going to take a moment here to reintroduce you, talking about efforts looking at junk science in the courtroom with Chris Fabricant, Director of Strategic Litigation with the Innocence Project, author of the new book, Junk Science and the American Criminal Justice System. You can join in 800-642-1234. Chris, one listener wrote in to say, a relative of mine was charged with murder of a three-year-old. It never went to trial, and this person is now incarcerated in another state. They said, my relative has always contended that he slipped putting the child into the bathtub, and they've wondered if it is a true finding, given that this evidence would be hard to scientifically repeat. He ended up accepting a plea agreement because he was told that if he didn't, that he would never see the light of day. And the listener writes, my relative is quite clumsy and learning disabled. We, the family, are looking for clarity and justice in this horrible accident. What could you tell us?
Oh, wow. That's a... really sorry to hear that. I obviously I can't diagnose, mm-hmm. you know, the type of science that was used in this person's case. What I can say is that the threat of junk science prior to a trial is powerful inducement to a plea, and that nearly a third of our cases, or less than a third actually, 20% of our cases involve innocent clients that have pled guilty to very serious crimes that they did not commit, often because they were threatened with excessive sentences or the death sentence. And what I can also say is that so many wrongful convictions involve uniquely vulnerable people, right? Elderly, babies, children. You know, there's this desire to punish and see justice done in those cases can lead to wrongful conviction. And I can also say that many of our clients who falsely confess or plead guilty to crimes that they didn't commit have cognitive deficits that are manifest in ways that make them susceptible to police coercion and pressure of the justice system to accept responsibility for crimes that they didn't commit. Obviously, I don't know anything about the facts of your listener's case, but you know, there are certainly elements there that would, you know, cause concern. And to the extent that the family can afford it, you know, hiring an independent pathologist to review the records is a good place to start in terms of, you know, was the science that was, you know, this person threatened with valid and reliable? Mm-hmm. Often it's not.
For a moment here, I want to just dial in on confessions, because I am blown away when you say that confessions are so persuasive that jurors have convicted innocent defendants who have presented, you know, DNA evidence at trial and then, you know, crediting the false confession over scientific proof of innocence. How can that be?
Yeah, that's incredible. And we have argued recently in Wisconsin Supreme Court for a ban on police officers lying to suspects during interrogations, because it's such an effective tool to get innocent people to falsely confess to crimes that they didn't commit. So the idea that confessions really trump all, and junk science is often used to coerce confessions, something like a polygraph, which we haven't mentioned as another form of junk science, or claims that a bite mark match or a hair comparison match, or that there's, you know, arson evidence or these other things, that innocent suspects feel cornered. They don't have an innocent explanation for, you know, why it is that, you know, their DNA is found at the scene, or why it is that their bite mark matches. And they're is a copious amount of scientific research to demonstrate how, even though you and I probably can't really comprehend how we would confess to a crime that they didn't commit, it happens with some frequency. And because it's so counterintuitive that any of us would confess to a crime like this, particularly a terrible crime like the murder of a child or something like that, is so powerful that it has several times overcome all of the other evidence of innocence presented at trial because of the persuasive power of false confessions. And you get false confessions in cases, and I write about a couple of them, where people are apologizing to the, you know, their alleged victims, you know, very, very persuasive confessions, but in the end, false.
Chris Fabricant, Director of Strategic Litigation with the Innocence Project, new book called Junk Science and the American Criminal Justice System. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a moment with Chris Fabricant here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about forensics and wrongful convictions. The Wisconsin Innocence Project was founded nearly 25 years ago. Fred Saker, who died last year, served 6 years in the 90s on rape charges that were overturned by DNA evidence. He spoke at a public hearing in 2018 in favor of boosting compensation rates for exonerees.
My six long years in prison and an additional year spent in county jail waiting for the two trials were filled with birthdays, holidays, celebrations of loved ones I could not attend. They were filled with moments I wanted to be a part of, but could not.
Join in 800-642-1234. Chris Fabricant leads strategic litigation at the New York-based Innocence Project with us for about seven more minutes. Chris, what does the process look like for exonerated people to seek compensation for years they served in prison?
You know, I write about Stephen Chaney, my first Innocence Project client in my book, and his struggles for first for freedom and then ultimately for compensation. It's never, never, never easy. And, you know, some states, very few, but some have adequate compensation statutes where once a person has been declared innocent, then compensation is automatic. Most of the time, that's not true. Most of the time, it's totally inadequate for lives being wiped out completely. And, you know, most of us would not spend a single night in jail for any amount of money, but, you know, certainly years or decades of their lives, and that can never really be adequately compensated. And, you know, so often, you know, it is perhaps your listeners have been hearing the debates around qualified immunity as it relates to police officers and prosecutors, you know, the inability to hold accountable the actors in the system that contributed or responsible for this wrongful convictions. That includes often the forensic experts themselves as well. So this litigation can be very, very challenging to get adequate civil compensation for the wrongfully convicted and or, you know, the problems with a state statute being inadequate to adequately compensate somebody for such a tremendous loss. So, you know, it's an ongoing struggle, and our policy department at the Innocence Project spends a lot of time lobbying for compensation statutes to be humane.
Here in Wisconsin, it's capped at $25,000 for wrongfully convicted people, or $5,000 per year. The cap is $25,000. Is that, I mean, it sounds incredibly low. How does that compare?
That's outrageous, right? I mean, would you spend a year in prison for $5,000. You know, I mean, it's just incredible. I've always been just astonished by the lack of compassion that is demonstrated by inadequate compensation statutes. You know, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that the state is so concerned that they're going to have to be pouring money out, you know, for these, that wrongful conviction is so common that this is going to be a big burden on the state to adequately compensate somebody. And I just can't imagine just how mean-spirited it is to be so miserly about an innocent person being convicted for a crime that they didn't commit. Entirely the state's responsibility, entirely. And to say that, you know, $5,000 is sufficient compensation for a year of your life being wiped out like that, it's just outrageous.
I want to just spend a moment here on Steve Chaney. You met with him 25 years into his sentence, and just that moment, you sitting down between the glass and you write about how Cheney saw you as a savior, and that really terrified you. Can you describe what it is like to do this work at the Innocence Project and what Cheney knew about junk science?
Yeah, I in the readings that I've done around the country, that's the piece that I typically read because it was such a powerful moment for me. I had been a longtime public defender before I went to the Innocence Project, and Mr. Cheney was the first client that I had met in person in prison. And, you know, public defenders are often, you know, looked at with great suspicion by their clients, often with good reason. But Innocence Project lawyers are viewed by particularly innocent people that have been in prison for as long as he had been as saviors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I arrived in Mr. Cheney's prison in Huntsville, Texas, you know, he viewed, you know, my coming there really as a manifestation of his faith. And it was a near religious experience for him. And he started weeping. And that was, you know, kind of more than I had ever anticipated as a lawyer, period. And it was deeply moving, and it was deeply terrifying to me because I knew that he expected me to get him out, and that because I was an Innocence Project lawyer, that I would be capable of doing that. And I was deeply skeptical of, you know, his chances, you know what I mean? And I think any litigator, particularly one in post-conviction doing the kind of work that we do, is inherently skeptical because, you know, there are so many obstacles to freeing the innocent that are deliberately erected to maintain the status quo, to maintain mass incarceration. Just to be clear, you know, I mean, is that junk science is really just a symptom of the much larger disease, that structural racism that underlies mass incarceration. And because of that, and because of all of the laws that have been passed to maintain the status quo, it doesn't just affect, you know, kind of, you know, what people that would want, you know, I mean, certain elements of our society being segregated from others that have committed terrible crimes, but it also impacts innocent people convicted for crimes that they didn't commit, and the ability to have those convictions reviewed gets harder and harder every year with every Supreme Court decision.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Fabrikant, Director of Strategic Litigation with the Innocence Project, author of the new book, Junk Science and the American Criminal Justice System. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.